Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. I'm a licensed clinical social worker practicing as an intuitive psychotherapist. You can find me several ways, either through my LA Talk Radio show page, which is latalkradio.com, All Things Therapy, or through my website, which is nolatherapy.com. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. And I'd love for you to reach out to me as my listener to know topics you'd like me to explore, guests you'd like me to interview, or if you're interested in being a guest on my show. You can email me that way or call to schedule sessions in person in either Los Angeles or New Orleans. I do phone, FaceTime, and Skype sessions with clients all over the world. So please reach out. I'd really love that. Subscribe to the show on iTunes and Google Play. It really helps my ratings and metrics if you actually rate the show as well. I really appreciate that. And if you like what you've been hearing, I invite you to support my work through the crowdfunding campaign I have through Patreon. It's patreon.com/allthingstherapy. They offer a platform for podcasters and authors and artists to be supported by our listeners and people that support us so we can keep doing what we love. Today, my show is sponsored by Audible. They offer over 180,000 book titles to choose from. And as my listener, they offer you a free month subscription and audiobook download of your choice. You can check that out at audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy. My guest today is really interesting. In moments, we're going to be hearing from Jean Dangler, PhD. She is professor and chair of the Department of Spanish and Portuguese in the School of Liberal Arts at Tulane University. Her research has been presented. She's presented her research at national and international conferences. She contributes year-round scholarly publications on the topics of her research interests, which include the history of the body, feminism, gender, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim studies in medieval Iberia, which we're going to hear more about. Medieval Iberia are the regions that are now modern-day Spain and Portugal. So today we are talking about her book, one of three that she has authored and published, titled Mediating Fictions, Literature, Women Healers, and the Go-Between in Medieval and Early Modern Iberia. And what I found really interesting about her book and work is that this book documents the professionalization of medicine, which we'll be talking a lot about, which is a time in Iberia when women and men that had typically been practicing medical techniques and healing practices were suddenly required to attend university study and licensing boards were formed. This was during the 14th and 16th centuries, and it was a systematic way to exclude and marginalize women from their normative roles as midwives and healers. And instead, in literature and in culture, they became targeted as syphilis-bearing whores and witches that later they were targeted as mentally ill in England. So Professor Dangler translates three 15th and 16th century texts for us by Roig, Roja, and Delicato to show us this progression during the late medieval and early modern times in Iberia. Welcome, Jean.
Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for having me.
It's such an honor and pleasure for you to be my guest. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thanks. Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about my work and some of these topics. They're really important.
They are important. And where would you like to start us?
Well, let me see. I wanted to just mention that, you know, my book, I'm not a historian, but the book is a literary study, but it's based on, it tries to make a link between some of the things that were going on in the history of the 15th, especially that, well, from the, about the late 14th through 16th centuries. And so what was going on in the history of the time in Iberia, or what is now Spain and Portugal, and three literary works from the 15th and 16th centuries. So it tries to link literature and history. Just to make that clear.
Yeah. So during that time, the 14th to 16th centuries, from what I learned in your book, there was this, through Western Europe, there was an attempt to elevate medicine and men physicians, and women began to be excluded and restricted. I don't know if this is where you want to start us, but it's one of the things that I noticed in reading your work.
Sure. Yeah, and that's really where the historical part of this begins. You know, women were up until, you know, the 14th century, traditional. We think the majority of traditional healers in society, and so there was a gamut of different kinds of healers that people had to choose from. There were physicians, but women often practiced in a fairly kind of non-professional way. They often were not university educated, but they were still highly respected and highly trained. Most people were trained by family members or others who perform the same professions, who operate in the same professions. And so often women and many men learn their trade just by doing them and by being apprentices and so on. Starting most in the late 14th century and then into the 15th century, there were several ways that Iberian society, or really royal and ecclesiastical authorities, began to try to marginalize women and Muslims and Jews from traditional practice. So, for example, there were the creation of licensing boards, who were, several people would be on this committee, and they would be expected, sort of like the AMA today, I guess, they would be expected to license practitioners, in this case, men physicians, university-trained men physicians. There were also laws enacted against certain practitioners in different municipalities and so on. So there were a number of ways that women and others were increasingly marginalized from these traditional practices. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to just note that what I found so interesting is that during that time, that women were multi-vocational, and many of them were dressmakers, shoemakers, or made perfume, and then they also might have been midwives and healers, and some of them working even with their husbands, and when the husbands died, they would continue in that trade. Can you talk to us some about that before the marginalization, what life
was
like?
Yeah, we think that's the case. I mean, it's really very difficult to know exactly sort of the trajectory of, you know, how people live their lives, obviously, or worked, but because women aren't often documented, there isn't a lot of documentation about women. We know a little bit from some case studies, kind of historical documents later in the medieval period, but we know in other ways, through literature often, that these women did exist. And so, for instance, in one of the books that I examine in my book, it's a 15th and 16th century work called La Celestina, and it In it, the one of the main characters, if not the main character, is a woman healer, but she also has a lot of different other professions. She's what's known as a go-between, someone who brings together usually young noble people for amorous, love relations. Mm-hmm. She also functions in a sense as an herbalist. She is sought out for remedies. She sells thread. She has a number of different occupations. Some of them in the book, what I'm trying to show in the book is that some works of literature at that time were written with very negative portrayals of these women. And so, Celestina, this woman from the 15th and 16th century, can be read she has a pretty powerful role in society, but she's also characterized as a prostitute. She basically brings down an entire kind of, family of people. It doesn't end well for the people that she works for, who hire her. So there are these ways that the portrayal of these kind of multivocational women becomes very negative during this period of professionalization of medicine. So that's really one of the main points that I'm trying to make in the book, and is that literature, at least in these three cases, has, I think, a very sort of complicit role with this, whether intentionally or unintentionally. I mean, in the case of Celestina, I've actually kind of changed my view or modified my view of that work a little bit. I mean, it's a very complicated book, I do think that one of the ways that it, or one of the effects that it had, was that it kind of showed people the dangers of going to, seeking out a woman such as Celestina for a remedy.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading your book, I was reminded of the propaganda even during Nazi Germany and Hitler coming into power, and the propaganda about Jews being different and less than, and even physical ways. And you talk about in your work the medieval formulation of the body and physiognomy, mm-hmm. and even how mm-hmm. female physical traits were interpreted as negative, like deep set eyes of a woman would mean that she is deceptive and not to be trusted, mm-hmm, and just mm-hmm. this whole propaganda in the literature, like you're saying, just to really negatively slate women and begin this whole very insidious movement to mm-hmm. disempower them mm-hmm. from the roles yeah. that they had held in different guilds that you wrote about, the medieval mm-hmm. guilds, and being midwives and doing things that were really naturally theirs. Can you talk to us some about that, like the physiognomy and physiological theory and such that you explore?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really super interesting part of I think that project is that, we really see that in literature where, people have certain traits that signify or that have a meaning, that they mean a certain thing, whether it be negative or positive. And, some of that obviously comes from you and many of your listeners, I'm sure, know about humoral theory and, the idea that bodies are consist of humors, and that really illness is caused by an imbalance of the humors, and that sort of cures are sought, or the way that someone is cured is when the humors are put back in place into their correct balance in a person's body. And then the physical traits are also really common, at that time. And it's when, we see this link between the physiognomy of medicine or of medieval medicine, and then just a sort of almost cultural tendency to start to point to people and say, well, that person looks that way, so he or she is that way. You know, so that it's really at this point that we start seeing the rise of, I think, difference between people trying to be made in much more categorical ways than in the past. And so, you know, the physical traits in women, so for example, Celestina, just to stay on that example,
yeah.
this character in this book, she has a beard. She, you know, she has a scar on her face. And so there are these ways that her body has the marks of, they're like signs or marks that have a meaning that tell people, well, this person is this way or that way. And so, you know, in her case, I think those sorts of characteristics are definitely meant to show what a negative figure she is and how dangerous she can be.
And I think at the same time, which is why I imagine you chose in your title Mediating Fictions, that Celestina was highly sought after and very well respected at the same time for her abilities and such. So in the literature, she started being portrayed as this very unattractive bearded woman, but yet also was highly sought. Can you talk to us about that kind of dichotomy?
Absolutely. It's really crucial. Because it gets at the heart of I think what's going on with the professionalization of medicine and sort of, you know, professionalization of different sectors of society at that time, where, you know, women, because they're traditional healers, they're often sought after more than men and men physicians. They're believed to be they're just more effective, and so people believe in their remedies and their interventions more than they do others. So, I think that, you know, that kind of, you know, in Celestina and in some of these other works, the characters seek her out. The other characters involved go to her for help. And I think that, you know, what these texts do is that they discourage readers and listeners from seeking those people who look like that or who resemble these literary characters. They discourage them from seeking out, you know, people who resemble them in their society, in their own society. So, you know, that desire or that belief that this person is actually the most effective healer in my town, you know, it was real. I mean, we do know that, you know, women, you know, as I said before, I mean, that women constituted the majority of healers in society and, you know, and they often were believed to be highly successful. So, you know, the professionalization of medicine comes along to, you know, to in part, you know, change the dynamics between of who can be who's authorized to be a healer, and you know, who we should believe in, who we should trust.
So I have a statement and then a question for you. I thought it was interesting as you laid out the professionalization of medicine and how there were four major developments that happened. That university study was required. There were laws enacted to regulate medical practice. There were licensing boards. And then the rise of hospitals and clinics. And women weren't allowed legally to participate in any of those. And you know, then there starts to be this, in my words, kind of demonization of women, and if they're herbalists, they're witches, and just the role of the church at this point too. Can you talk to us some about that?
Yeah. Let's see. It's you know, let's see. So where to begin on this? it's a big
topic.
Yeah,
take your time.
You know, sort of the negative portrayal of women is often linked in the Middle Ages to the figure of Eve. I mean, at least in sort of Christian, we should say, you know, kind of Christian, the Christian worldview. So at this time, late 14th, the text I'm dealing with, the works I'm dealing with, Christianity is really aiming to dominate in Iberia. You know, after sort of three different religious communities and better said cultural communities, you know, live together, throughout the Middle Ages in Iberia. And so, you know, a lot of things start to shift in the 14th century to change that dynamic between those different faith communities. So in my book, we're sort of at the tail end of that late 14th and especially late 15th and then 16th centuries. And by that time, Christianity does dominate. And so in this sort of worldview, Eve is often the sort of the obviously the first sinful woman. And she brings in, and so in the Christian worldview, Eve, you know, brings down humanity, but especially women. But then on the other hand, and we see this in literature in the Middle Ages, Eve also has a contrasting woman figure in the figure of Mary, the Virgin Mary. And so so that we in Spanish, we use this sort of dual name for women, or I should say a sort of dual way that women are thought to be characterized. So there, it's Eva, Ave. Eva is like the name Eve, and Ave, they're two words just spelled, they're spelled backwards, or you can spell each the opposite way in Spanish. So in Eva, Ave, so women are thought to sort of embody these two principles, the sinful woman and the woman, the woman who can be redeemed. And so, I don't know. I mean, definitely, I don't know if I would characterize I wouldn't characterize the professionalization of medicine as the demonization of women, but definitely we know of laws that clearly stated that women should not practice, or that they should only practice as midwives, for example. There are these ways that women were no longer authorized to practice in their traditional roles. The other part of that is the creation of the Inquisition which happens, which really is not a medieval, it's not a medieval phenomenon on the Iberian Peninsula. It's really a very late 15th and 16th century phenomenon. And that often the inquisitional or inquisitorial boards are made up of lawyers, and they are seeking out heretics, but so women do kind of begin to be identified and associated with heretical, sort of anti-Christian practices. So, for example, just to go back to this example, the example of the Celestina. Yeah. Celestina is a figure who is definitely associated with the devil. I mean, we see her in one scene where she's basically, you know, casting a spell, you know, conjuring a spell so that she can basically seduce a woman for this man who wants to be her lover. And so there's a definite link in that work between Celestina, this multivocational healer, go-between, and her work linked to the devil. So it's very real in the literature. We definitely see it in the literature, and that's I think really a change from the way that women go-betweens, women mediators are depicted in literature prior to this time. So it is, it's definitely an important shift.
Well, and I read as well that women healers were tried for civil disobedience in Paris and punished publicly in, mm-hmm. say, the church doorways, standing mm-hmm. there without shoes, without clothing. Mm-hmm. So definitely the mm-hmm. humiliation, just how humiliating that
definitely.
Would be publicly.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that did go on. I think sometimes there's... We do find cases of that. I'm not completely familiar with the history of that exactly, but I do know that, you know, sometimes I think some of the numbers of women, or sort of, you know, the idea that all the Inquisition did was seek out witches and kind of identify women with witchcraft and so on. And there was a good deal of that, although it wasn't as sort of dominant, from what I know, as sort of what's still often popularly believed. But okay. definitely the public humiliation. I mean, those references to that kind of public humiliation are made also in the literature, in the Celestina, the literature that I'm examining in my book. And so we do think that, I mean, that those forms of public humiliation were very real, without a doubt.
And then the third book that you translated, La Lozana, talking about syphilis appearing in Western Europe in the 1490s, and La Lozana being this described as having no nose, her face kind of eaten away by syphilis, but yet was also desirable and very seductive, and again, kind of like mediating opposites. Do you want to talk some about that work and influence in your book?
Yeah. Just to clarify too, I didn't really translate these books. I mean, my work is I'm working with the Spanish text, you know, and in the case of the first book that I dealt with, or that I examined, it was it's in Catalan. So yeah, I didn't translate them per se, but you know, I'm just trying to investigate or examine certain ways that they kind of confirm, you know, what I also saw happening in the history, or the ways that they link up with what's going on with the historical record in society. So the last work is written a little bit later, and it takes up a figure of a woman who moves from southern Spain, Seville, the city of Seville, to Rome, and to there are references to other parts of Italy as well, and the illness that's sort of forefronted in that work is what we would call today syphilis. It's really called bubas. B-U-B-A-S in the text, but if I were sort of revising my book, the book was written in 2001, but if I were revising it, I would probably have tried to avoid more using the term syphilis, just because it's sort of more of, it's a much, much more modern idea of this illness. You know, it's just called different things in its own time.
Sure.
So, but it really kind of does a very similar thing as Celestina. I mean, it depicts this woman as desirous, desirable, I should say, but at the same time, there are these characteristics, things about her that also indicate that she's diseased. So it kind of gets back to the very, you know, points that we've been making today about the effect of the professionalization of medicine, and also, you know, this kind of link to women as, if not demons, at least sinful people.
Right, syphilis being a sexually transmitted disease that
exactly
it was a sin. Yeah, even though there were brothels and male brothel owners, that women used to manage brothels, but they even got pushed out from that and marginalized as well. So that, and again, I think that double standard in our culture still, that a man, if he has a lot of sex, is just being a man, but a woman's a whore. And so those themes, even back then.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, without a doubt. You know, that kind of this hypocrisy, I guess, if you will, of, you know, sort of society. And yet, you know, here, you know, anyway, yeah, I mean, it's just sort of played out, I think, in this literature.
And it reminded me, which I think you might have even referenced in your book, much like AIDS was used to stigmatize gay men, the poor, and IV drug users early on, that the disease, you call bubba, which is now syphilis, used as well back then. I just remember some of your passages talking about even the men that would visit La Lozana, like they couldn't stay away from her, even though she was portrayed as being so unattractive and this just horrible, sinful, disease-filled woman. But then somehow for them, it was them being virile and manly and pleasurable, like sex could be pleasurable for them. So just that, you know, kind of how those themes we still deal with in our modern times.
Yeah, very definitely. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's, you know, and even going, and then going back kind of to early parts of this book, you know, I think it seems like every age has its sort of either sexual or love related disease. And so in the Middle Ages, the disease of lovesickness really dominated. And so the idea that lovesickness was a disease that afflicted usually sort of more higher class, noble people, especially men. But the idea being that sort of excessive meditation on the woman beloved would cause this person to become ill. And so, for example, in Celestina, that's the very illness that Celestina is sought to cure in one of the main male character. But so as sort of time moves on, the emergence of bubas becomes sort of, well, we could just kind of interpret or see it as sort of taking the place of that in a way. I mean, it just becomes a disease of the time that's affiliated or I should say associated with sort of sex, love, and it becomes much more sexual in nature.
Yes.
Lovesickness was really more like a mental sort of meditation. It was rather than sexual. So it's just kind of interesting how things shift.
And I think the prescription at that time, if I remember correctly, was distraction, trying to distract the person from their love object and their thoughts. And then I know the role of messenger healers for lovesickness.
Yes,
exactly. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So the idea being that, you know, one of the best ways to heal someone of lovesickness was to distract that person. So, you know, you could, and we see this in Celestina, where people talk about the beloved in a very negative way. Oh, she's very ugly. She's hideous. She wets her bed, you know, whatever it may be. And so there are all these ways that, healers are supposed to distract the afflicted person and try to dissuade that person from this excessive meditation, this excessive thought on the beloved. So yeah, that is one of the key ways that lovesickness was thought to be healed. But and Celestina does the exact opposite. She brings the lovers together. So that's sort of the other indication that she's, you know, completely, you know, very dangerous.
You know, and what I noticed too, Jean, is I think that still exists today in even modern psychology, that if someone's upset about something, grieving the loss of a relationship even, to let's just jump into another one, or let's go have sex with someone else. Let's not deal with our feelings and move through them, but let's distract by something else more exciting. And it was just interesting to me that that was happening back then in this medieval and early modern time, you know, that the prescription was to let's distract. And then Celestina came along and had a different approach to really let's deal with this and bring the, you know, person together with their pain, which I think, you know, in some ways we really have to go through our wounds to heal them instead of covering them up or running away from them.
Well, that's an interesting insight, Lisa. I guess I would say in Celestina, it's you know, there's really nothing good about her bringing these lovers together. It really brings about the demise, their demise, and the demise of other characters in the work. You know, in the book. So it's, I mean, from your perspective, from our perspective today, you know, we might see that as positive, bringing people together, having to go through the pain afterwards. But in this book, it was it was an absolute disaster. And so, you know, I mean, who's at fault is really Celestina, because she's the person who brings them together. But I think that's a really interesting insight and sort of link to the present. I'm not sure what to do with it, but it's an interesting contrast.
No, and I appreciate what you're sharing, because even before we came on live, I was telling you how I so enjoyed your book. And in some ways it was like I was intimidated by it first, because it's so rich and in historical context, and not being a Spanish speaker, I knew I was going to miss some points. And I said, please correct me. So I appreciate that you just did, because here I am just a survey of your book, as opposed to you taking these years of study and research. So I appreciate you letting our listeners know that during her time, the bringing together of lovers was disastrous.
Well, at least
healing.
Yeah, I mean, at least in that context, it is. You know, in the world of Celestina, and in the world of the writers, the people who put that book together, it really is. It was a disaster, and it was not part of the medical advice either. I mean, usually, you know, for many illnesses, what's kind of interesting too, that a little sort of topic we haven't talked about that's really interesting as far as traditional women healers goes, is that traditional women healers often practice the same sorts of remedies. They all often had the same sorts of remedies that physicians, university trained physicians, had as well. I mean, so everyone was sort of, remedies often usually consisted in the Middle Ages of herbs, and sort of putting herbs together in a particular way, and so on. So women become, you know, one of the ways that they're marginalized and sort of denigrated is we've already talked about associating them with kind of the devil and that, but also trying to drive a wedge between some of the things that they do and some of the remedies of university trained authorized, you know, men practitioners. So it's, I think I've gone off a little on a different topic, but anyway, that I just thought it's an important point.
Yeah. You know, Jean, I was curious too, that you wrote this book in 2001. Is that when you were at UC San Diego?
No, I got my bachelor's, my BA at UC San Diego in 1980. I finished in 83 and actually went through the graduation in 84. So a long, long time ago. No, I got my PhD and wrote that
at Emory,
and wrote the book. Yeah, at Emory. And then the book is derived from my dissertation. But by that point, in 2001, I was at Florida State University. Right now, I work at Tulane University. But so at that point, I was at Florida State.
Well, I was curious about your personal process in writing this book. I had so many aha moments. And before coming on the air, we spoke briefly about just the invisibility, so to speak, of women's history. Yeah. And just wondering kind of more about how this is your wheelhouse and this is what's important for you as a person to disseminate and share about. Could you just talk to us about some of that experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. I just always been drawn to, literature that has to do with women and women's history and so on. And you know, I was really struck by there aren't a lot of depictions of women even there in medieval Iberian literature. And women often don't have a voice in literature in the Middle Ages. It's just often very difficult to get at, you know, how women lived. So I just started thinking about these figures of these mediators who are, you know, relatively prominent in different works of literature. The Virgin, for example, is definitely considered a mediator, and there are, you know, many poems. We have a long history in on the Iberian Peninsula of poems, miracles having to do with the Virgin, that I think she certainly represents a sort of a spiritual mediator who's extremely powerful and is sort of the other side of the other face of the Eve
Mary, right,
that
you were
sort
of
duality. Yeah. So I just started thinking about all of these different women mediators in medieval literature, and, you know, how different the depictions are in these later medieval, sort of more early modern 16th century texts. And so that's kind of how I came about doing this project. My advisor, the person I worked with, Michael Solomon, who's now at the University of Pennsylvania, but he, you know, he had worked a lot in the history of medicine and literature and medicine and so on. And so he helped me sort of think about, you know, the medical healing aspects of, you know, what was going on in this literature and at the time. So that's sort of how this project started.
It's just so interesting and so deep and rich, and that's why I stumble, because I'm like, wow, there's so much here. It's hard to know everything at just reading one of your books, but I love your research and your work, and I think it's such a valuable contribution to our culture.
Well, thanks. Yeah, you know, I always start my classes with especially with undergraduates, you know, asking them what they know about the Middle Ages and what they, you know, how they think about the Middle Ages and so on. And if we're, you know, working in a class, we have, you know, literature about women, what they know about women and so on. And it's just, you know, many people, especially young people I work with, you just kind of think about the past in terms of stereotypes, you know. And so it's often, you know, really a challenge to bring my students and people, you know, around to seeing that women actually really do have a history. They're not completely invisible.
Right.
You know, it's and that women were always doing things. I mean, I think one of the ways that you know, people think about the past and women's history is that women were all, you know, people have the stereotype that women were sort of shut up in houses and, you know, didn't do anything, took care of children and made meals and, you know, so on and so forth. So, but it was just the opposite, you know. Women, it seems, from many different walks of life or different walks of life were definite participants in society. And, you know, so that's part of what my book, why the importance of my book too, and of some of the research that others have done on similar topics, is that, you know, women have always been visible in society. It's just that for some reason that we have a difficult time sort of in more of at a more popular level of knowing that.
Yes. So since this book, you've published two other books, what's mm-hmm. next for you in your work?
Well, I'm actually, at this point, I really think I'm going to be returning to one of the first book that we really didn't spend a lot of time talking about today, but I'm trying to work on, I've been working on for a while now, looking at the relationship between the first book and that I, the literary text that I analyzed in this book by Roy, you're yeah. right. And it's called The Mirror. And looking at the relationship between that work, which is a very misogynist work, and a later 15th century work in Catalan that's by a woman abbess from the same city of Valencia where Roy lived. And sort of we think that her book, which is called a Vita Christi or A Life of Christ, we think that her book is actually a kind of proto-feminist or pro-women response to misogyny in Reutsch's Spiegel, and so or Espejo, mirror, and so I've just really grown increasingly interested in the relationship with those between those texts, and so that's one of the projects that I'm working on and that I'm going to continue to work on in the next couple of years.
That's so interesting to me. I can't wait to hear more about it. Is that what you'll be studying in Spain this summer as well? I know you go to Spain each summer to research.
That's right. I am going to be doing some continuing research on that project this summer briefly. So I'm real excited about that. And I hopefully have a sabbatical, not next year, but the year thereafter. And I'll be spending a lot more concentrated time working on that project as well.
And lastly, if listeners wanted to reach out to you about your work, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Well, I'm completely accessible via email. Do you want me to give that address? Or
yeah,
is that,
absolutely.
Okay. My email is my first initial, J, and then just J Dangler, so J-D-A-N-G-L-E-R, at Tulane, T-U-L-A-N-E. .edu. I also have a sort of faculty profile on my department's website, and I think you have that link. I think you have a link to that, don't you, Lisa?
That link will be posted on LA Talk Radio, attached to this show. So listeners, you can reach out to Jean that way as well.
That's right. And I think my phone number is on there as well. So either way, it would be great to hear from people.
Yeah, I really appreciate you being my guest today. Is there anything else that you want to speak of before we conclude?
I don't think so. I've really enjoyed it, Lisa, and thank you very much for having me. I know I'm sort of an outlier. I guess I'm not a healer. I'm not a therapist.
You're a teacher.
I am. Thank you. Well, very nice.
Important role. Yeah. I think
you.
In this lineage of women healers and teachers and such, that certainly we are in that lineage.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah. And I was just so excited to be able to talk about, some of the ways that I think different ways that we can think about women in the past.
Yes.
So I appreciate it a lot.
You're so welcome. Thank you, and have a really awesome rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jean. Bye. That concludes our show for today. Please listen in next week as I bring you another episode, and I hope everyone has a really good week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir.